This meeting is now being recorded.
Great. Well, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the RPM subteam for URS Documents call on Wednesday, the 21st of February, 2018. Attendance for today's call will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now?
Rebecca Teschnet.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. And I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. Thank you. With this, I'll turn it back over to J. Scott Evans.
Thank you very much. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, everyone, depending on where you're located in your particular geography. This is the subteam that has been tasked with looking over our unified document for the review of the Uniform Rapid Suspension System, also known as the URS, to determine, as we look at the issues that we will be grappling with if they've been identified in this document, what data we feel we need to collect in order to consider the issues that we will be processing. So I look at this document, and we're going to just go through and we're going to talk about what types of data we will need and how we will get it, who we will reach out to and get it. And there is also an expectation, I think, of in the event we identify something that we either feel like we would get from practitioners or that we would get from the providers, that we would share that information with one of the other two groups that are putting together data gathering questions for those particular groups. There's one, I think Kathy is chairing a call today on a subgroup that's dealing with identifying practitioners in the URS and identifying a list of questions to seek data from them. And I think Phil Corrin is also chairing at the same time. He will be chairing a call that will be considering the providers. So with that, does anyone have any comments or concerns before we get started in this process? Any questions? Okay. I'm not hearing any, so let me check with staff. It appears that the document, the unified document, which is appearing here, dated February 1st, 2018, is untethered. So that means that everyone has the ability to scroll through the document within their own Adobe Connect room. And unfortunately, Rebecca is only on the audio. So when we get to a particular section, let's make sure that we are clear about what we're talking about. So if Rebecca's trying to follow along by hard copy, she knows where we are. And if she's not, at least she knows what general topic we're talking about. Is that okay with everyone? Great. Okay, so the first thing that we are going to be considering, and you notice we have these high-level questions that we are looking to answer. Has it been used? Why or why not? What was the original purpose? And is it being fulfilled? Bearing in mind the original purpose, have there been any unintended consequences? What changes could better align the mechanism with the original purpose or facilitate to carry out its purpose? And what was the ultimate outcome? So those are sort of a rough knit five questions, high-level questions that we were going to put to each category that is listed in section part one of the review topics. And so I guess I would ask, as we look at these, we think what information we feel like we would need to answer those high-level questions with regards to that material. So let's start. We have the complaint. You notice we have, I think, four. I'm going to scroll down just to make sure I'm not misspeaking. We have four areas under the complaint that we are going to consider: standing to file, grounds for the complaint, can't, limited filing period and administrative review. And so for this, I reach out to the group and would pose the question, what data do you feel that might be necessary to seek in order to answer the five questions with regards to the complaint and the subject categories that are underneath the complaint? And if you'd raise your hand in the pod, that will help me. I see Barry Cobb has raised his hand. I'm sorry, Barry, if you raised yours earlier, I was not set up to see that. So I will call on you, Barry.
Thank you, Jay Scott. Barry Cobb for the record. And no, it's to speak to the first section A of the complaint, and basically just to repeat what was stated on the last plenary call of the RPM working group. Past perspective, if there is any data requesting out of this particular section, it would likely be coming from the providers. The data we've collected to date doesn't touch upon any of those aspects, such as standing or grounds or limited filing period, and certainly the administrative review. I do recall that someone had mentioned either in the chat or on the call that especially around the administrative review, it might be an interesting metric to understand how many submissions had been denied before they were carried on to a formal complaint. And honestly, I don't know what the details or process around that, so I'd certainly invite any one of the providers to maybe shed a little bit more light, you know, or at the very least, since most of them are from Forum, perhaps they could just produce some kind of percentage of how many that came in versus that were rejected from via the administrative review versus we already know how many wound up becoming actual cases, which is 827 up to 2017 across the three providers. So at any rate, just to recap, I think that any discussions this group has about this section likely will be leaning on the providers to get to that data. Thank you.
I see Zach has raised his hand. Zach?
Thank you. Zach Muskovich. I just wanted to ask the group if they can provide me with some clarification. I recall that there was a chart that was shown on the Adobe Connect in the last group meeting. I believe it was prepared by Rebecca in conjunction with staff, or something along those lines. And I'm wondering, and there, I recall there was discussion about the scope of it, and Rebecca had indicated that the scope was too broad, not that she thought it would, for her study purposes, it was just right, but maybe too broad for the group, and the group, some members of the group said it's too broad, but I'm wondering whether that is a starting point for this, so some of the questions have already been laid out in that, or is that something else entirely? Thank you.
This is Jay Scott for the record. I think what you're referring to is the Excel spreadsheet that Barry showed, where he had showed the information that he had collected from scraping data from the provider site, and then he had categorized some additional information that was in the more subjective area that required some sort of case review. And in preparing those categories of information, he had put together a table in Excel that had the information he had gleaned, the categories he had laid out, and then also some additional categories that he had identified when speaking with Rebecca and her research assistant, Alex. However, this group did not endorse going forward with that particular review, nor has there been any endorsement with case review. So having said that, we just need to identify where we think there are areas and where we think we can get data. I think Barry has indicated that at least with regards to one point under here, the administrative review, that there's possibly queries we could make to the providers about administrative review, at least to ask certain objective-based questions with regards to how that has worked as a filter to give us some indication of how that is working. I think that's what he was suggesting, and I see that Renee has raised her hand. She is from a provider, so we will hear from her.
Thank you, J. Scott. Renee Fawson for the record. I agree with Barry. I think really the only data from this first core under the complaint that we would be able to provide would be a data on which how many cases have been rejected. I think that would be a pretty consistent data point, and I don't know that we've changed the way we've kept track of that since the inception of the URS, so I think that is probably the only data point that we would have for those first four, just to confirm if it makes it easier for the group to move forward on this issue.
Okay. Do we feel like that might be something that we, this is J. Scott Evans for the record again, that we might ask the group working with practitioners to ask about is the their experience with regards to 1, 2, and 3? Renee.
I think that's true, and I also think that when the providers are invited in, I think we can provide some insight on some other issues regarding 1, 2, and 3, too, but there isn't any hard data points associated with those.
Okay. All right. Yes, I see David McCauley.
Jay Scott, if I could get on the queue, please. It's Rebecca.
Yes, is there Rebecca?
Yes.
Okay. We'll do David, and then we'll go to Rebecca.
Thanks, J. Scott. This is David McCauley speaking, and I'm new to this group, just signed up yesterday, and maybe I misunderstand, but I have a question probably for Renee about standing to file, and it's whether the providers require one critical element of standing is that a ballot mark exists, and is that based on simply an assertion, or is there actual proof that has to be attached to a complaint to prove that there is a mark that's been in effect? Thank you.
Renee, do you want to answer that question quickly, and then we'll go to Rebecca?
Sure. As I understand the question, do we do some sort of administrative review to make sure that there is a valid trademark included in the complaint? And I will say that we don't make any assumptions, but it's required that there is evidence uploaded, at least with Forum System, that there's evidence of a trademark uploaded with the complaint. So we don't make any judgments on whether that information is valid, but we it's a requirement that information is uploaded. That's about all I can say at this point on that point.
But if I'm not mistaken, this is J. Scott again, you have to have your trademark registered in the TMCH to use the URS? Are they tied together?
Renee Fawson for the record again. They aren't necessarily tied together. The SMD file, which I think we've had extensive discussions on in the group, the data that I've been able to pull on that, of the 780 cases that Forum has had approximately, I think only 280 cases have actually had an SMD file attached as evidence. Otherwise, it's some other form of a registration, proof of registration.
Okay. Thank you, Renee, for that. Rebecca, you're in the queue.
Thank you, Jay Scott. This is Rebecca Tushnet. So I just wanted to step in and I feel like I hate having to say this again and again, but the words subjective and objective are being tossed around in weird ways. So if we get data on how many people's submissions have been rejected rather than accepted as complaints, Jay Scott, you suggested that would tell us something about whether the process is working. Working is a qualitative judgment. You can use the numbers to get information about it, but it's the numbers alone will never tell you whether the system is working. Likewise, the fact that you may need qualitative assessments of the cases doesn't make them subjective. For example, one of the things that we might want to know is, you know, is the trademark at issue mentioned in the decision? I'm pretty sure we could come to 100% agreement on that, even though it does require coding. So I worry that objective and subjective are being tossed around in ways that don't reflect what we should be doing, which is figuring out whether the system is working, and if not, in what ways it should be changed, which are always going to be qualitative assessments. Numbers are always only helpful in that. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. Zach?
Thanks very much, Zach Moskowitz. With regards to what David had mentioned, and Renee's answer to that question about the trademark and its interplay with the URS regime, perhaps under the complaint, and because it's essentially a standing to file aspect, we could add whether word marks or TMCH clearinghouse registered marks, or on occasion and improperly a design mark was submitted and relied upon by the complaint. And so that's the first point I want to make. The second point is I have no intention of going off on a tangent or misdirecting the group, but I just can't help but think when I'm listening to this going through here, and maybe others feel differently or similarly, that we had a semblance of a chart, whether the scope of it was agreed upon or disagreed upon. And so I'm wondering if we can't have a discussion about the chart, if the chart covered a lot of this ground already, and then we can move on from there. Just a suggestion.
John McElwain.
It's John McElwain for the record. So I think we have our one data point for the complaint, and I would request that we move on to coming up with data point to look at for what we have under the notice.
Okay. Thanks, John. I wanted to query whether we feel like we may have two data points under the complaint, because I suggested that perhaps we might be able to reach out to practitioners with regards to inquiries 1, 2, and 3. Because it seems like those are all things that affect complainants and so and respondents. So if we have practitioners that represent those, perhaps we could ask questions of them around these three data points that would solicit some data for us. And I'd like to see if that's an agreement that we can come to. If that's so, we can turn that over to the practitioners working group subgroup and suggest that these are areas that we feel like they could elicit data for us. I see Barry Cobb hand is up, and then I'm going to call the question with regards to my suggestion about practitioners.
Thank you, Jay Scott. Barry Cobb. I just wanted to respond to Zach. So, you know, the data that staff has collected, again, is still at a very high level and only scraped from the summary views from the providers. So as we move down this table, there are a few elements where that data that we've kind of identified buckets, again, for lack of the better word, like such as response or standard of proof, where that can be a guiding point. But again, that data is only a very minimal amount of fields that we were able to extract to dive into details about the response or standard of proof or scope of defenses will require this group or some other group or Rebecca's analysis or D, all of the above, will require greater detail to get into being able to answer some of these questions as they're identified here. So that chart that you keep referring to is kind of a starting point to help us corral certain cases that may apply to these different sections, but that's only the starting point. Thank you.
Thank you. Brian Beckham?
Thanks, Jay Scott. I guess I wanted to just second what John McElwain said, which is, and I think you've been saying, we can look into the decisions to see if the trademark is listed. That's what's supposed to ground standing to file a complaint. I think it's risky to look at, to ask practitioners to provide examples. Kathy submitted an email to the list last week from John Berryhill, which was obviously cherry-picked for effect. So you know, he raises a fair point about the type of mark that was submitted. But I think, you know, the point is that it will be difficult to have a fully representative data set if we're just asking practitioners to submit examples. So I think we can look to the decisions themselves to see what mark is listed, and that should suffice for this purpose. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks so much. I have a question to Barry. Barry, the data that you were able to scrape, does it give you the mark that was cited in the complaint?
Jay Scott, negative. That would require going into the individual cases, and to my knowledge, the only activity in that regard thus far would be Rebecca's and her RA's efforts.
All right, thank you. We're going to need to move on from this. So I'm going to call on Zach one more time, then I'm going to call a question. I think Brian has spoken up that he doesn't think that the practitioners of A are a good pool to seek data. Then my question would be to the group after Zach, are we only going to look to the providers with regards to administrative review and four, and then we're just, what are we going to do for data with regards to the other? Do we believe that there's no data available, and therefore I need some answers from you guys and some guidance, because this is a bottom-up consensus-driven process, and my job is only to try to pull us through the outline. Your guys' job is to come up with suggestions of how we need to proceed, and I need to hear from folks, or either we're going to stay in the same place that we've been for the last 3 weeks, which is arguing about a bunch of stuff and not moving forward. So we need to try to move forward if we can. So, Zach, you were next. Brian, is that an old hand? It's still up. I didn't know whether you wanted to. Okay, Zach, and then I see John McElwain has raised his hand. So, Zach.
All right, Zach Muskridge, thanks very much. So Brian Beckham raises a good point, is that if we go to practitioners to look at this issue, we're not asking them for anecdotal evidence or what they have seen from their own experience or from the handful of decisions that they may, as panelists, have viewed. What we're really asking for is, what in the case of trademarks, what kind of trademark was submitted? What was it, a TCMH registered trademark? Was it a word mark? Was it a design mark? And I understand from Renee that they identified that the complainant would have complied nominally with the requirement of having a trademark that is relying upon. But if we're asking for something more than that, I agree with Barry that it's a study, not a deep study, but it's something that you need to look at the complaint to identify it, to the extent that it's identifiable. And I imagine from the sum that I've looked at that it is readily identifiable as at the beginning of a complaint. So I think that's something that we would either need to have volunteers to look at the cases, or rely upon third party or staff or whoever it is, but something that actually requires eyeballs on the decisions to get an answer to that. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, it's my understanding that the decision will tell you, may or may not tell you whether what the trademark is, but we don't have access to the complaint at this point. I think that's correct. John?
Hi, John McElwain for the record. So, Jay Scott, I think part of the problem is that we're dealing with they're not even questions. They're just statements that are so high level and broad that we need some more detail to develop any potential data sets that could be studied. So, for instance, we're talking about one, standing to file. I mean, that's, I don't even really know what that question is about. I think it is, if you look across, whether we should be able to expand the standing to allow marks that were abusively registered but may not be confusingly similar or identical. So I think some of, you know, when I say I think we have all our data, I think we have all our data for the points that I understand could be examined under the complaint. But otherwise, without further guidance as to what these points mean, grounds for filing, I mean, I don't, we know what the grounds for filing are. I think we can move on to the other, to Section B, because I think a lot of the points that people are raising are addressed later on. I think if we scroll down, we would see if you
okay.
want to really, that we'll hit those. So anyways, I'll shut up and hopefully we can move on. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, John. All right, let's go to notice of complaint. So you see here there's a receipt by registrant and effect on registry operator. So, Barry.
Thank you, Jay Scott. Barry Cobb for the record. So in regards to the notice itself, again, I just wanted to repeat what was discussed on the primary call. I don't believe staff has access to this kind of data. Again, it's obviously the cases where a response was made, they likely received the notice one way or another. Beyond that percentage of the 827 cases where there was no response, we won't have any idea about how the note, whether the respondent actually received the notice or not. And, you know, about the only way that I could possibly come up with an avenue by which there would be access to that data is if somehow the providers kept a log of their SMTP files, that the email of the notice was sent out, or if there's any physical delivery of the notice through snail mail, that there's some sort of record behind that. And the third component, going back to the SMTP aspect, is if there was any rejection of that email sent to, that was identified in the complaint itself. Again, that's probably even beyond the providers that attend this call. That's more an IT kind of aspect of being able to get to that data. It's probably going to be difficult because I doubt logs are kept for in perpetuity. But perhaps the working group might, in understanding about the notices, you know, a possible requirement could be that there is some sort of logging of notices that are sent if they're not done so today. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. I see Brian Beckham and then Renee.
Thanks, Jay Scott. I wanted to just point out here, I think we are in some sense going to be kind of always chasing our tails. What we're effectively looking at is data to prove something that we, by definition, in some cases, cannot know. We, you know, when we provide notice under the EDRP, we sometimes get bounce back non-delivery receipts. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we get a response. That's obviously proof that delivery has been effective. But if we actually look at the URS procedure, the requirement is actually that the provider undertakes certain steps to discharge its obligation in terms of due process to the registrant. So I think, in a sense, just to recap, the data on this is going to be always elusive. We can see if there are responses. Obviously, in those cases, we will know that the registrant had received notification. For the cases where there's no response, it goes to the point Barry was making. It really gets into how providers track that. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. So I'm afraid that this is something where we may have an incomplete picture, and we have to just look at things like are there responses, or and I would note in that regard, even if there's not a response in the initial case where a determination is made, there are the various 6-month and extended appeals options, so we can look to see have respondents been invoking these where they weren't receiving notice for whatever reason in the first instance. Thanks.
Okay, and I suppose we could also look at the 14 appeals to see if anybody appealed claiming that they didn't receive notice. I mean, we've got 14 cases. I know it's not a huge data set, but it is something that might tell us something. Renee?
Renee Fossen for the record. I just wanted to second what Brian said and kind of tie it back to what Barry was saying earlier. Yeah, we probably did get bounce backs. I don't know how those are kept. I've looked into that recently, but it's not been consistent. And the other wrinkle is that for a response, we count that as a formal response. The party may have emailed us and, you know, hurled insults or had some other sort of correspondence with us that's not necessarily a response for the case. So to track that, we as the provider would have to go through each and every one of those files to determine if there was an email sent that isn't technically a response.
John McElwain.
John McElwain for the record. So I agree with what Renee and what Brian said. I think we ought to look at what is the process that the providers go through to provide notice to the registrant, and I'd recommend that we refer that to the practitioners group, see if they notice any flaws, you know, and I think we kind of need to get a little bit of the detail, what happens if it's hidden behind a private privacy proxy, and see if they notice any issues in their experience by comparing it to what that the process is. So I would say that this is a good one for the practitioners group.
Okay. Would you also agree that maybe for the providers just to find out what steps they take, what the process is?
Yes, I think they, if they wouldn't mind putting that together and that being kind of reviewed by that practitioners group, I think that's a nice melding of the process and any flaws that any practitioner has seen as a result.
Okay, thanks, John. All right, looking at the response. I don't know what data set, I mean, this is just off the record, I mean, it's going to tell us about the response fee. And other issues with regards to, I mean, we have, what is it, Barry, 167 cases where a formal response was filed?
Jay Scott, this is Barry. I think it's around 250 where there was some sort of response. And of that, we can find out about, you know, there's probably 10, maybe 15 cases where there were 15 or more names as it relates to this response fee that, you know, we can cherry pick out of the master data set to take a further look at.
Okay. Zach?
Yes, thanks. It occurs to me that perhaps under the response or perhaps under remedies, there needs to be a look at the notice and locking of the domain name. So I'm looking at the URS procedure, and at 4.1, it says that upon completion of the administrative review, the URS provider must notify the registry operator that the complaint is deemed compliant, et cetera, et cetera. And then within 24 hours after receiving notice of lock, U.S. providers shall notify the registrant of the complaint. So there may be some room there for us to find out, you know, how that occurs and has it been complied with, and if there's any difficulties in affecting it, any lack of responsiveness by registries, whether the names are and effectively locked? Because I know that from a complaints perspective, that's a very important aspect to the URS, and it also speaks to whether the URS is working in that perspective. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So it seems to me that you're suggesting that with regards to that, that the providers may have some good information with regards to how that process has worked and if there are any sticky points with regards to it that have caused frustration in how the process works. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, Moskovich, in response to that, J. Scott Evans, yes. And just throwing this out there, but maybe we should hear from registries as well to see how they feel about their role in participating in this, whether it's been manageable, whether there's improvements that can be made in terms of how they're expected to respond. Thank you.
So did you say the registries?
Zach Muskowitz, yes, registries, thank you.
Okay. Next I have, I think it's Brian, and then I have Barry.
Thanks, Jay Scott. I'm not sure the question, Zach, if you wouldn't mind explaining a little bit. Admittedly, I don't follow the URS as much as some others might, since we focus really on the UDRP, but I wasn't entirely clear on the relation of the registries. But I wanted to just suggest one possible data point in terms of the response, which is, are there appeals, whether they're due to the time extension or the other types of appeals that the URS allows. And then just for us to bear in mind that this, again, I think is going to be a difficult area to identify strong data, because I think it may have been Zach, somebody on the previous call mentioned that in a lot of these cases, it's a conscious decision by a registrant not to respond because it's just not perceived as you know, worth their while. And so that brings me to the last point I wanted to make, which was on the question of the response fee. Of course, to some degree, the notion of the response fee being applicable in cases where there are more than, I think it's 15 domain names at issue, is a bit difficult to pin down when there's not clean and accurate WHOIS data across the board. So it could very well be the case that a response which had triggered that fee provision could be in play if the WHOIS data was accurate. I'm not suggesting that we go down that rabbit hole, but just to mention that this is more of a policy question than a data-driven question in terms of a response fee. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Brian. Barry?
Thank you, Jay Scott. When you had called on me, I wasn't prepared for us to have moved on to Section C. So, I guess just to restate. So, basically what I'd mentioned in the last call, and to be clear here, and again, this kind of refers back to the chart that Zach had mentioned, you know, out of the 827 cases, 40 of them are withdrawn, so we can set those to the side for the purpose of this discussion. Of that 760 or so, 518 of those did not have a response, so we can set those aside for the moment, even keeping in mind Brian's point about whether the registrar responded, intended to respond or not. But the remaining of about 250, which is close to 50%, I think it's just below 50%, there was some sort of response. And so a couple of things here is, you know, in terms of looking at those types of responses, you know, we can take this bucket approach of, like was mentioned, well, let's look at the 14 appeals, at least just from a response perspective, and we can understand, you know, did they respond within 14 days or did they respond within 6 months? Was there an extension? How long were the responses from the original case versus the appeal? So, you know, those are, again, we can cherry pick those exact cases and look at those individually and try to extract some kind of meaning out of that. Secondarily, and I'll point out again, and I'm not trying to speak for Rebecca, but based on their coding structure, they'll at least provide an initial overview of all of those cases that they're reviewing. One of the check marks that they'll be looking at, is, and again, it's only of these 250 where there was a response, was it within 14 days, within the 6 months, or an appeal basis? And so when that data is aggregated, there might be some other meaningful trends that we can identify out of those, as opposed to this group just focusing on a more tactical basis of looking at perhaps the appeals or perhaps where the claim was denied or something along those lines. Thank you.
Okay. So as I'm hearing Barry, he seems to indicate that he believes that we have about 250 cases that we could look at to glean information with regards to C, and I guess probably E, because in those where there was a response, there would be if a defense is put forward, it would be put forward in a response. I just want to know, is that a group, does this group feel like that's a good data set to look at, for the C and the E, is to look at those 250 cases where there was a response filed and sort of tease out from those what we can tease out? I see Zach has his hand up.
Yes, thank you. Just to answer your question from my perspective, yes, I think that's a good idea, and that's a good place to start with that bucket. And then I believe in answer to Brian Beckham, if I'm not mistaken, had mentioned he wanted clarification on the locking aspect. It wasn't Brian, I apologize. But just to clarify on the locking aspect, that's a real key provision that we need to look at under one of these headings. And so it seems to me that it's probably in between complaint and response. So we should make room for it because the lock enables, requires the registry operator to lock the domain within 24 hours of receipt of the notice of complaint. And that's a key provision for a complainant trademark owner so that they know that there's not going to be cyber flight or some kind of transfer of the domain name that's subject to dispute. In the meantime, we can count on the proceeding going ahead with the domain in the possession of the current registry. And that's a data point that we could glean, I believe, from querying primarily the dispute resolution providers to see if they have received those within 24 hours of the request to the registry operator, whether there's been any delay or pushback or lack of responsiveness by registry operators in compliance with that obligation. It's also something we can ask the registry operators to make sure that they're receiving a request through their proper channels and that they have enough time to respond to it and the system works for them. Thank you.
Thanks, Zach. I thought we'd already agreed that probably the best place to check those things would be to check with the providers to go to the provider group and say that their data from providers on implementation of the remedy would be some very valuable questions that they could ask the provider. And I certainly hope that's something that we will do. Barry, your hand was up and now it's down again. Is that because?
Yeah, Jay Scott, I was just going to say, but then I put my hand down. I mean, another possible area is looking at who is records for, you know, whether the lock was applied or not. But it wouldn't be foolproof as, you know, it's not a guarantee that a record was always captured at the time of the lock. So never mind that. So I'll just withdraw that idea. And it'd be pretty tedious to get to that. kind of data via who is. So I think a more qualitative approach of asking the providers and or the registries themselves on their experiences would be better.
Thanks. This is J. Scott again. Here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that's the only place, because our only question is whether this is operating as it's intended. It's set out in the policy how it's supposed to operate. So our question is that the reality or are there problems? And if so, can you identify what those problems are? And is there a way to either tweak the policy or do some sort of procedure that would eliminate the problems that are identified by either the registry or the providers? It seems to me that's all we can ask. So, Barry, you raised your hand again.
Yes, thank you, J. Scott. I'd just like to advise the group that I'm taking notes over here on the right-hand side, and I'm not the world's best real-time note taker, so you're probably seeing gaps over here to the right. I just want to let you know that I'll go back through the recording and clean these up before I send it out to the list. And I can also, you know, once I'm essentially, as we go through each section, I'm trying to put make some high-level notes or based on the deliberations. At the end of it, I'm going to try to identify those elements for, you know, possible data areas. And then I can go and attach those or make an edit to this document that we see in the Adobe Connect room and create a chain of custody as to, you know, how we input these into the various boxes in the table. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Moving on, do we have – so that seems to me that we've handled responses. It seems to me we have a pool of data, 250 or so cases that we can look at to glean some information from there. I'm not sure what we can look at for standard of proof, but for defenses, again, those responses, to answer have they been used, are they being used, that kind of, with regards to remedies, it seems to me that we can look at the remedies and my question for the group would, should we send something to the practitioners group requesting information on scope of the remedies, whether the practitioners feel like scope of the remedies are sufficient or insufficient, because I think that's a question, but it looks like the other two questions I think we can get from, you know, we can also get some information about all the implementation questions I think we can get from registries and the providers. Zach, I see your hand is up.
Many thanks, Zach Muskovich. So with regards to standard of proof, I agree, J. Scott, that kind of information can be obtained from practitioners to some degree. Just to frame what the issue could be with standard of proof is that we know what the standard of proof is supposed to be, the clear and convincing, but we don't always know how it's interpreted. We don't know what's the best way of interpreting it. So some analysts will, in honestly fulfilling their obligations, interpret it one way, and others may, for all we know, interpret it a different way. And so from the perspective of both complainants and respondents, some uniformity of interpretation would be ideal so that complainants can know if they're able to bring a winning case and response can know what would entitle them to win the case. And so how do we identify how the standard is being interpreted and what evidence has been used to meet that standard? That's something, once again, that can only be done through eyes on the decisions. And so the extent that practitioners are willing to look at these decisions, particularly, I believe, Barry Cobb, 57 cases where there's been a denial, or 58 rather, that could be a bucket to look at to see what the standard was, how it was employed in denying those complaints, whether it was properly employed. And also, you know, by looking at the entire body of the cases where responses were filed, how that standard was employed. So I'm in favor of putting it to practitioners, but I would be hesitant to ask them only for, you know, anecdotal evidence or for a small examination of a handful of cases. We should really have some people, whether they're volunteer practitioners, working group members, or otherwise, looking at that whole, I believe, is 200-plus buckets that we were looking at before.
Thanks, Zach. This is Jay Scott. I was speaking from my personal capacity. I guess I'm frustrated with this because, you know, I've been practicing law for 25 years, and any standard of proof, whether it be preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing, I mean, that's the reason we have appeals courts, correct? It's because there's a lot of disagreement. Usually the loser believes that the standard was incorrectly applied. And I think you can get various degrees of that in any system, and it's pervasive throughout both systems, any system where there is some sort of standard of proof, there's disagreement. So I wonder how you can get any sort of data with regards to that other than to acknowledge that there's always going to be some sort of disagreement with regards to it. And I find that sort of frustrating. And I'm not sure how to get data with regards to it that would show us anything. I mean, other than to, you know, you could look at appeals and say, while there's disagreement on the standard of proof and whether it's being consistently and accurately applied, it was only appealed so many times. You know, I just don't know. I'm going to call on John, Barry, and then I'll go back to Zach.
Just got John McElwain for the record. I completely agree with what you just said. I'd actually probably go one step further and say I would object strenuously for us recommending to the practitioners group to take a look at the clear and convincing standard as suggested by numerous people. I mean, it's just, as you identify, for all the reasons you identified, it's simply not possible. I do think the practitioners group can look at exactly what Zach is getting at. Since we must accept that clear and convincing is a standard that is on the high side of the evidentiary proof, and because it is not as clear. Again, if it were clear, you, I, and all the other attorneys on this call would not have a job, that we look at that from the practitioner's side as from the standpoint, is it a barrier to URS cases being filed? But whether it's been applied in a manner that one or two or three people find to be unclear is not for the purview of this group, but I think practically, is it a barrier? Should it be lowered to encourage URSs to be filed? That would be a legitimate and worthwhile examination. Thank you.
Thanks so much, John. I'm going to go to Barry.
I'd like to get on the queue, please.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, Rebecca. It'll be Barry, Zach, and Rebecca.
Thank you, Jay Scott. And I'm trying to call in Mary a little bit, and unfortunately she's not here. One of the things that we had discussed in staff in terms of looking at this particular section, of the defenses is really kind of falls around the URS procedures of 5.7 and 5.8 that do specifically call out either, you know, on claims of bad faith registration or bad faith use. And as Zach mentioned, you know, with the 58 or so claims denied, what could possibly be a data element extracted out of that is understanding that if the respondent did prevail, did they prevail on one of the seven that were identified in 5.7 or 5.8, or was there some other standard by which they prevailed that wasn't listed in those two sections of the URS procedure? And if so, what were they? And perhaps there can be an eighth one that would be added to the procedures or not. And again, she's more experienced at that than I am, but that could be one possible way of looking at that particular bucket as it relates to the defenses. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebecca?
Thank you. So I guess I
want to say, I think that the practitioners can be asked for their experiences, but it is true that they won't be a representative sample, so it has to be coupled with a broader understanding of what's going on in the universe of cases. I'm puzzled why we would ask if we should lower the standard of proof without having an idea of why we would do that, why we would make it the UDRP. So obviously that's a policy question. If we want to ask the practitioners, I guess we can, but we should probably also ask them, should the standard of proof be raised, right? Why not? Clear and convincing is lower than some. But more to the point, I guess, I would be interested in whether the practitioners think something like a guide for, you know, what are easy cases, what are hard cases, would be helpful. I know the question of whether there should be, you know, UDRP precedent is a big one, but precisely because the URS is a different kind of proceeding, we might be able to say more about the very clear cases that the URS is for with some exemplars. Would that be helpful as part of the standards given to the examiners? I think that's worth discussing, maybe with the practitioners, maybe among ourselves. I agree is that there's not necessarily data that we can collect that will help us understand that qualitative assessment. Thank you.
Thank you. Zach?
Thank you. Zach Muscovitz. So, yeah, in regards to your comments, J. Scott, about the troublesome or the impossibility of better defining the legal standard, and I think as John's comments, that we'd all be out of jobs any easier. I agree entirely. You know, what I'm struggling with, however, is that I know that we're probably we'll never be able to come up with a better standard of proof in terms of the language, and it will always be subject to interpretation. But I am also cognizant of that when having looked at, you know, the 58 decisions where complaints were denied, I did see some, you know, fairly significant variation between how panels look at it. And so if part of the working group is to ask the big question, is the URS working, I would think that the standard is the linchpin of that examination, because we really need to know, are complaints being denied that ought not to have been denied? Are responses being dismissed that ought not to have been dismissed? And so my question really then is directed not to necessarily reframing the standard for any greater theoretical specificity, but there should be, in my mind, some kind of examination about whether the URS is working in terms of the standard of proof, because that's really one of the most fundamental questions. It's probably, this is as important as procedural ones, aren't getting noticed, things like that. Is the URS working for the parties? And so that's why I think there should be some examination of that. And to Rebecca's point, yeah, an interpretative guide, you know, by stakeholders, by experts could be very important in that interpretation. To provide guidance to the parties and to the panels. But even before we get to that point, we need to see what areas need guidance. And this, to me, is one that stood out just from an informal look at those 58 cases. Thank you.
Thanks, Zach. John?
So, this John McElwain for the record. This may come as a surprise, but I agree with everything that Zach and Rebecca have said, essentially. We need to keep in mind that this group is looking at what, you know, what data and documents can we look at to answer these questions. And I would be fine to presume that the clear and convincing standard is one that could use some guidance wrapped around it. We don't have to study it to make that determination. Let's presume that to be the case. And let's let this group, or the not really this group, but the working group as a whole, come up with some best practices to ensure that There is more uniformity, like an overview 3.0 for URS cases, but it's not necessary to look at 58 cases or whatever and see if people have an issue concerning the determination of clear and convincing. Let's presume that we're here to improve it and come up with some strategies. Again, not this this particular subcommittee's purview, but I think we can probably all agree to that and move on. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Brian Beckham.
Thanks, Jay Scott. Just on this topic, I'm a little concerned that it might be premature. I think Lori on the last call mentioned that in the early days of the EDRP, there was similar confusion around all cases. And I think we may just have to accept the fact that that's where we are with the URS. A lot of, discussion has been had about, well, in one case, the domain name wasn't being used for websites, and of course we all know that could be used for a phishing campaign or what have you, and there doesn't need to be content on the page. But, one of the tenets of the UDRP and the URS is that the decision maker can apply the legal principles it thinks are relevant in the case. And of course, in the UK courts, there's case law that says the mere registration of certain domain names, irrespective of whether they're ultimately used, can amount to passing off, and that would be bad faith in this context. So, and I think, we can maybe look at some information and try to, if it means there's a practitioner's guide or we, but I guess what I want to say is it may be premature and we need to say, there have been some questions raised about how the standard's been applied in certain types of cases, but that we need more time to let the cases settle and with another year or two or so many hundreds of cases behind us, we can have a more informed picture of how these are being applied. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So I appreciate Zach. You have raised your hand, so I'm going to call on you.
Yes, Zach Musbridge. I agree with what Brian had just mentioned there, that as with the UDRP at the beginning stages, it's an evolving body of case law with the panelists hopefully gravitating towards a consensus ultimately on those crucial issues about what complaints should win, what responses should win, et cetera. And I think that it will become clear in the future. The difference, I imagine, between where we're at with the URS and UDRP fundamentally is we never had the real opportunity to conduct this kind of review earlier on with the UDRP, and that is a lost opportunity, one we need not necessarily lose with the URS. I imagine this working group will carry on for some time, but by the time we get to that point, maybe the case will have evolved to a more critical mass, as Brian pointed out. With regards to, I'm sorry if I'm getting names wrong, but I think it was John McElwain who had raised the point that can we just assume that there needs to be some look at the standard of proof issues and interpretation issues. That seems to me to be a good point in that it's something that we need to look at. But then again, it leads to the question, as he pointed out, who's going to look at it? So I think we're the people that need to make that decision about looking at it. So I suggest that we do it through some means. I'd be open to suggestions about how, but in my view, the best way of looking at it is initially to consult with the practitioners to see what kind of anecdotal issues they may have identified from their experience of reviews, and from there we could look at what the possible solutions are, whether it's interpretive guide, whether it's adding some provisions into the URS to give better direction to panelists, et cetera. Thank you.
Okay, so I need, Barry, are you capturing this now? What data we pointed to as possible solutions, because that's the thing we're going to need to coalesce around so we can make recommendations back when we are in San Juan, is that we've looked at this, that we've considered the various topics, and this is the data we believe that this is the data source and what we need to collect. And I would most be interested in, from staff, getting sort of a summary of what we today have decided should come from practitioners and from the providers, so that we can get that information to those two subgroups so that they understand. They may already be there, but just in case they're not, what our thinking is around where we think we may need information from those two groups. I'm Barry.
Thank you, J. Scott. Yes and no. Like I said, I'm not the best real-time notes taker, but I do intend to go through the recording to clean up the notes that I've captured and specifically identify those possible data elements that we've talked through up through Gen D. In doing that, not only will, you know, this just be a part of the notes that gets sent out to the list, but I do intend to add those elements that were identified today into the fourth column of the document in the Adobe Connect room in redline form, of course, so that that can also be reviewed. We've gone through quite a bit, and I think it's, you know, been much more productive in this little sub-team than we were with the larger group of identifying these elements and possible areas for data. So that leads us about, we're probably about halfway through the document and maybe continuing on with remedies. And so I'll leave it to you whether we kind of stop here.
Yeah,
for
I'm very sorry to interrupt. This is Jay Scott for the record. I thought we had handled remedies and that, that's, again, looks like something we would want to go to the practitioners group with regards to 1 and 2, and then providers with regards to 3, if I'm not mistaken. But maybe I've misinterpreted. So I call on people on the phone to keep me honest, but I thought that's what we had decided. Yes, Barry.
Jay Scott, this is Barry. So you briefly touched on remedies, but I thought most of the dialogue was still back around Section D on standard of proof. Like I said, I'm going to go through the recording and I can, you know, I can confirm that scope of remedies and duration would go over to the practitioners. I just note that there might be some data elements that either staff and or Rebecca's research might also produce in relation to the duration of the suspension period. I think this comes to how in a prior meeting I had kind of highlighted, you know, the approach that we were talking about, and I used the first two URS cases, which were for IBM, and it was pretty clear to see that in looking at that analysis that, you know, truly once the case was decided and the complainant prevailed, that the domain was truly suspended. And then after the suspension, or, you know, basically the domain expired, thus the suspension concluded, and that the brand picked up the name via the DPML from the two donuts TLDs. So, you know, looking at that at the aggregate, I think, you know, there could be some informative discussion about what is really happening to the domain once it does expire after the suspension period, and that can inform, for example, the duration of the suspension period as a topic here, in addition to whether, you know, this is passed over to the practitioners as well. At any rate, to answer your question in a much shorter way, I wasn't aware that I don't think that I actually caught all the actions of what remedies we would do. So either we need to go through that now in greater detail, or I'll go back through, try to document the best that I can from what I hear from the recording. But I'd kind of suggest that maybe we circle back on remedies when we meet again next week.
Okay. I mean, I'm open to hear what folks have to say about remedies now. What data. Yes.
Jessica, could I get on with you?
Please.
Sorry, this is this is not about remedies. It's just I was continuing to think about the other issues. I wonder if we could ask staff to go back and dig up what, if any, exemplars of easy cases versus harder cases were discussed in actually formulating the URS to see if there's anything there that might provide guidance for people going forward. If there is a need for that, maybe we could compare what we have now to what the framers expected the URS to cover. And so that would be a document or a set of documents that might be useful to us. And sorry for going backwards. And, J. Scott, I appreciate you doing your level best to keep us on track. Thank you.
No, not at all. And I think that's a wonderful idea. I think we should go back to the IRT and STI report and look at those sections that cover the URS. I think they're set out. We don't have to review the whole report. We could just get the sections that are specific to the URS, I believe, and that would be sort of a good data point to look at with regards to remedies. Did I see Brian Beckham's hand come up?
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Jay Scott. Just briefly, I thought you might have actually mentioned this, but to Rebecca's question, I'm not 100% sure if this would be in the IRT reports, and it may have been from the consultation that we did out in San Francisco, but my recollection was that the notion was that, and this is what I think drove the clear and convincing standard being adopted versus the preponderance of the evidence, was that this was a case that was so obvious that you could decide it while you're reading it over a cup of coffee in the morning, so it shouldn't take more than 10 or 15 minutes to make a decision. So that was so obvious, it was clear and convincing. If there was any question, you denied it, and they can file a UDRP case with more evidence in the pleadings and a more reasoned decision.
Okay. Well, I think, but I do like that Rebecca has suggested two additional data points that we could look at, and that's the STI report and the IRT report. And I see that Mary Wong has agreed with that. We've got 15 minutes left. So I also think with regards to, Barry, if you could, with regards to remedies, put some time in sort of formulating what you had discussed previously about looking at, you know, sort of the life cycle of, you know, what happens, was it suspended, what happened after suspension, and that kind of stuff, so we can have an idea if that's data we want to look into. I think with regards to, and people call me out and argue with me if you disagree, but with regards to review of implementation of current remedies, that seems to be squarely in the data we need to get from registry operators and the providers, because they're the ones that are having to deal with this and sort of find out what the process is, find out where their pain points are, get those pain points down, and see if there's any recommendations we could make that would eliminate those pain points. I think with regards to scope of the remedy and duration of the suspension period, I think, you know, looking at the IRT report and the STI reports is good, but I think it would also be good to talk to practitioners, because they may say, well, you know what, half of my clients won't file this and file a UDRP instead because of the remedy. I don't know if that's the answer. I'm just saying practitioners would be able to tell you better than, you know, than I would. And it's my understanding that it's going to be a very strong push to make sure that we get balanced views from practitioners, that we don't have just one camp that identifies with one particular viewpoint or not. I think John McGowan has raised his hand again, and I'm going to cede the stage.
Thanks, Jay Scott. Just something I put into the chat, but I believe that there is some data in the INTA study on reasons that the URS was or was not used in some at least, I'm not going to say conclusions or whatever, but at least some trends can be gleaned from some of that data from like an anecdotal basis. So I'd suggest that we have that as another data point to capture.
Okay. All right. That seems like a fair point. All right. And then Mary has also suggested the CCTRT report. And that's a good data point as well for us to consider. Okay, we've got 12 minutes. Do we think we can look at the appeal process and consider what data points we can consider here? I'm open to folks giving me an idea of what they think acceptable data would be for us to review. Any thoughts? John.
John McLean, for the record, maybe looking at the appeals, you know, just the numbers and maybe outcomes, just looking at, you know, whether it's been overturned, upheld, and I don't know, and I might kick this to Barry or Mary, whether it's even possible to look at whether there have been any national appeals of URS decisions. Thanks.
Okay. I also think you could look at least look at the appeals process to look at the appeals that have been filed to find out where they fall in the appeals process, correct? As far as timing. Were they filed, you know, immediately? Were they filed, you know, within a year? Those kinds of things to look at sort of the timing of them. I know it's a very small pool, but it would give us some indication of whether these things are being used, whether they've raised their head, because I do believe there has been some question raised in the primary working group whether the appeals process as it's currently formulated from a timing perspective is appropriate and necessary. So, I mean, we could at least look at those to see what has occurred to date. And I think that is our best data to sort of look at the appeals process to see how it's been used to date. Is there any disagreement with that? Is there agreement with that? I'm not seeing anything in the chat, nor am I seeing any flurry of green checks coming up, so I'm not sure how I'm supposed to gauge silence.
So, Jay Scott, this is Barry.
Yes. I'm sorry, Barry. Trying to monitor the list down to the bottom, I see now you've raised your hand and Brian Beckham's raised his hand. So I will call on you, then Brian.
Yeah, no worries. So from the appeals perspective, you know, I think I agree with you that either this group or whichever group does it, again, this kind of goes back to the bucket analysis that staff was has been talking about for the last several weeks. And, you know, I think we're in a somewhat fortunate place that there are only 14, which is a very small bucket for us to actually just look at all 14 of the cases. And, again, not necessarily honing in on the outcomes or the decisions, but we have a spectrum by which to look at them. So, you know, of the 14, One resulted in a split decision at the appeal. There were two appeals that where the claim was denied. There are 10 appeals that looks like it maintained the suspension of the domain. And then there was one appeal as well where originally was found in default, but I think that the complainant still prevailed as well. So, you know, I don't think that it would be much effort at all for this group to actually just, you know, as, and I can document this in the document, but, you know, here are the 14 cases. Everyone in this group kind of takes a look at each one of the 14, takes high-level notes, or perhaps we create some sort of quick survey to document for each person to document their findings on what they extracted out of the appeal process, and then we can collate that and likely answer most of what is being asked for under Section G. Thank you.
Okay, I think that that is a good a data point. Brian?
Yeah, thanks, J. Scott. In terms of your question about looking at the appeals, I think that would be relatively easy to do, and we can. I know one of the questions that was raised during the development of the URS was, you know, what's the right balance in terms of giving losing registrants an opportunity to appeal their case, but also not having this hanging over the complainant's head for too long. And so there's a question about whether this 6 months plus 6 months appeal process is striking that right balance. So if we find that people are filing these on day 364, maybe we say, okay, they need the time, and that's that. Or if they file within a month, we say, you know, maybe we can strike a better balance. And then related to that, there were two different possibilities. There was one kind of a normal appeal and then a de novo review. And so maybe we can look at, of these, albeit limited data set, you know, which types of appeal or de novo review are being invoked, and is it actually beneficial to have both of these, or could we kind of combine this into one, you know, more simple system? Thanks.
Thanks. Great. So we've got 5 minutes left in the call, and so here's what I'd like to see done. I'd like to see Barry put together, after he's had a chance to go back and refresh his memory based on the recording, is to, under each topic, sort of list out where we believe that the data sources are. And I'd like to, if possible, on the chair's call on Friday, be able to refer those data points we believe we need to refer over to the practitioners group and the providers group, at least with regards to A through G. So these are areas that we think that they should provide, they should be looking to gather data for us from those two groups, and of through A through G, where we've identified that we could get help from providers or practitioners with regards to obtaining data. So that means that once Barry circulates his summary, we need to have everyone let us know if there are any strong objections to what he said so we can get that vetted. And I would say focus on the areas of referral, because that's the only area that I'd like to move forward and get it out to the other groups so that they can start formulating questions with those. If, with regards to the other, you can make comments and we'll come back, and the first part of our agenda next week is that we could, if there's agreement here, look back over what Barry has put together as our recommendations, a summary of our draft recommendations, and we can consider that and spend like the first 30 minutes going through and make sure that we're like on, we have our recommendations set in stone for A through G, and then we can move on through H through, is it M or L? Through N, and do this same process again. Mary, I see your hand is up. I'm not hearing you. I've seen you typing in the chat a few times, but I can't hear you. Can you? Okay, do you want to type what you want to say, and I'll read it in the record. In the meanwhile, I see that there's a hand going up by Barry. Okay, Barry's going to speak.
Hi, Jay Scott. Barry.
Okay, Barry.
Yeah, so I think staff's going to need a little bit more time. You mentioned about trying to get all of this coordinated by the co-chair's call on Friday. I'm not sure we're going to have all of that ready by then or not. But we will commit to having the notes and an update to this document by Monday. I do agree with you that for our call next week, we can spend the first 15 minutes or so to review what we completed up through Section F or G today. I think we will need to circle back on Section F on the remedies just to confirm, but anyway, the first part of the call, just to review what we got through up to Section G appeals today, and then spend the remainder of the call next week to do exactly the same process for the remaining sections and be able to complete this part of the effort. But I would like to suggest that, you know, there are some of these possible data elements that are dependent on the other subteams. I think it may be better to send it over as one package instead of trying to piecemeal this to have them get started on some of the aspects here. So perhaps that's a deliverable from the conclusion of next week's meeting, that then staff will make sure this is all packaged together and we can properly coordinate.
I guess my concern with that, Barry, sorry to interrupt, is just that aren't they only meeting these two calls? And so if we don't get them some information with regards to, we think that they can provide us data, their meetings will be finished. So would it be easier for us if you just go through this, when you go through the transcript, just pull out those areas where we have felt like we'd either go to the petitioners group or the providers group with letters A through G and seek information and questions from them, and that's all we kind of concentrate on up front. And then we circle back and do a full report after we've got that gleaned together. Will that work? Okay. Because all I really want to do is identify from our discussions today where we thought we could get information from the practitioners and the providers and just get that information to those two groups. With regards to the broader things, you've got more time with regards to that because we don't need to get that till close of the day on Monday so people can have Tuesday to review it before our call on Wednesday for our review of where we ended up. Is that something you think you might be able to do, is tease out just the things that we thought that we would need provider and petitioner input, get that put together, send that around, and then we'll look at the broader aspects of all the other nits and nats and areas we thought that we wanted to get data, and we can do that and review that on next week's call. Is that something that you all think you can help with?
Hi, Jay Scott. As Mary pointed out, we'll try. We're competing with several things going on.
I understand. I understand. Okay. If nothing else, I can give. If the group is not opposed Because I didn't hear anyone say, I heard Rebecca say that practitioners may not be the only group we want to consider in certain situations. So that, I'm interpreting that as that doesn't mean we can't ask the questions, but I think she's saying we can't limit our inquiry to just that data. So if in the chair's call, if I put forward sort of what our thinking is and give them sort of an overview of what our thinking is with regards to where we might need data so they can get started, and we could, with the caveat that we could, that doesn't mean that's the only data, with the caveat that if in our next call we refine that, we might contact them again. Is that, does that sound like a plan? What I'm just trying to do is keep momentum rolling while we can, guys. I see John McElwain seems to see that's okay. I'm not seeing any a flurry of no's. Don't do that. David McCauley says that's okay. So that's the way I'm going to proceed, just to keep the momentum rolling. I want to, first of all, close the call, but I want to thank everyone for the very productive and good, strong, robust discussions today. I think this is, as Barry pointed out earlier, from a staff perspective, I think he feels like this has been one of the more productive calls we've had. I would have to agree. This is hard work. It's hard slog. And I just want to remind everyone, as we go through and we look at the additional information, it is okay to say the data does not exist. That is an answer. And we could say our recommendation is that you need to start capturing this data because it is relevant and needs to be looked at. So I just want to remind everybody, if we don't get too frustrated if we get up to things where we don't have, we seem not to have the perfect answer, because that may be our reality. With that, I'm going to bring the call to a close. I thank you, everyone, Rebecca, especially for your patience being following us audio only. I really appreciate it, staying up on the call and staying so relevant with your comments. With that, I'm going to give everyone back. We've run over about 4 minutes. I apologize for that. And we will talk again next week, this same time slot, I believe, to have this further this discussion, to do a review and continue on with the rest of the category. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone, for joining. Today's meeting is adjourned. You can disconnect your lines and have a good rest of the day or night.